next 3 weeks. Now, since everybody is just getting back from a vacation, I'm not necessarily very organized here yet, and I know that there are formal websites and so forth, and we're just not really organized or connected with all of that yet. So I put a couple of things like a syllabus and a reading and so forth on a temporary website, and there'll probably be a more official one later. But this is... My name is Paul Lanneker. I am a theoretical physicist. I work in Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study and Princeton University. And much of my professional life, I have been involved in the Standard Model, especially the electroweak part of it. I'm also very interested in beyond the Standard Model and supersymmetry and superstring theory and things like that. But this this mini course will be entirely devoted to the Standard Model as such. Please feel free to ask questions during the lectures, and I will be around during the day. And if you have questions, I don't think it's necessary to post formal office hours or anything. But my office is, I think, 271, just down the hall, and just drop by if you want to. Chat or ask questions or anything like that. Okay, are there any sort of general questions before I start on the introduction, the real introduction? Okay, I should advertise that this is a very abbreviated version of my own textbook, The Standard Model and Beyond. I don't know yet whether they have a copy in the library here, but if you want to learn in much more mathematical detail any of the topics, I will obviously recommend that as a source. Also, on that website, I have some other references, such as a link to a write-up of some talks at other schools and so forth that provide some extra information. A great reference is for anything in particle physics, also for a lot of related topics in cosmology and astrophysics, is the Particle Data Book, which is all available online. The links are again on the syllabus there. And that's a big fat book, the printed version, but fortunately everything's online. And everything about particle physics, there's all kinds of review articles in there on every topic you can imagine within particle physics and related astrophysical topics. Okay, I'm going to assume that you are familiar, at least at some level, with with basic field theory and how to do simple calculations, at least at tree level. And your first tutorial this afternoon will be a review of some aspects of that. I understand that you only just seen it the first time last semester, and so you are probably not all the great experts, but at least I'm not going to repeat most of that information, although tomorrow I will give a little bit of the review of some of that aspects. So what I'm going to do in this course is describe the type of field. Field theory is a basically an abstract concept, just like quantum mechanics. So the relation of this course to a field theory course is just like the relation of an atomic physics course to quantum mechanics. I'm not so interested in the formalism, but rather the actual application to the world we live in. So basically, another way of putting it is the field theory relevant to our universe for distances smaller than about 1/1000th of the radius of the atomic nucleus. And this is what's called the standard model. When I first entered the field a very long time ago, we did not really have, particle physicists did not really have an understanding of what was going on in particle physics. There was a good theory, quantum electrodynamics for QED, and there for electromagnetism, and there were some reasonably successful phenomenological, that is not fundamental, models for the weak interactions and a lot of knowledge about the strong interactions, but not a coherent underlying theory. And in the last 40 years or so, however, such a theory, the standard model, has been constructed and tested in just about every aspect. And the culmination of that was a couple of weeks ago in Stockholm when Englert and Higgs received the Nobel Prize for their predictions that go under the names the Higgs mechanism. And I was actually very honored. I actually got to attend that ceremony. That was quite interesting. It has been so we now really have a theory that's well-tested to great precision in many aspects that describes just about everything we know down to a distance scale, 1/1000th the size of the atomic nucleus. There are a couple of missing ingredients. We know that from astronomy that there's dark matter and dark energy. We don't know the nature of that, so those are sort of missing from the standard model. But everything else we understand. Now, this is probably not the ultimate theory of nature because it's, as we'll see, it's a very complicated model. I should call it a theory or whatever. Those words have different meanings in science and in the popular vocabulary. We know it's very complicated, as you will see. But so there's probably something that underlies it. And that will be the subject of other courses on Beyond the Standard Model, although I hope at the very end of this course to have developed enough to be able to point out clearly what the difficulties are, what the fine tunings are, and all the different parameters and arbitrary features. So that's the basic idea. Now, a rough outline, as I say, on that website, there is a syllabus and in which I tentatively put down the topics for the 15 lectures. I may have to modify that because it's rather ambitious. But basically, what I hope to do is following. So today is introduction to high energy physics and to the standard model. And then tomorrow will be quantum electrodynamics, and in which I'll mainly introduce notations and talk a little about the actual experimental successes of quantum electrodynamics. And I will also emphasize the Noether theorem. Which is an example of the importance of symmetries in particle physics, in other types of physics as well. And the reason I'm emphasizing the Noether theorem here, and if you don't know what that is, I'll explain it roughly tomorrow. It's our first introduction to how so much of our physical theories are connected to invariance or symmetry principles. And this is such an important thread that I will then spend a couple of more lectures just generally on the subject of symmetries and groups and non-abelian gauge theories. I am assuming that you have seen, you know, the basics of QED, but probably you haven't seen much about non-abelian gauge theory, so I'm not going to assume that you're really familiar with that. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. One of the hardest things in any course like this for instructors is to come in and I don't, you know, I haven't been here in the fall and I wasn't in your classes previous to that, and so it's very hard to know exactly where to start and what level. So feedback is very useful. If I'm spending time on things that you know very well, tell me. If I'm assuming something that you've never seen before, tell me. So this is actually an enormous topic, symmetries. I'll have to introduce something about groups, group theory, representations, but mainly Lie groups, which is a special type of continuous group, which have so much application in physics. There are groups, symmetries associated with space and time, or extensions of space and time. There are groups that are associated with so-called internal symmetries that have nothing to do with space and time. There are discrete groups. There are continuous groups. There are so-called global groups or local groups. There are exact groups. There are explicitly broken, spontaneously broken, chiral groups, and all of these things are very important. So this is we'll take a couple of lectures at least. I then want to talk about QCD, quantum chromodynamics, which is the modern theory of the strong interactions. Chromodynamics, yes. And coming back to what I said earlier, when I first started in the field, I think nobody seriously thought that anybody would understand the strong interactions in the next 100 years. But we do to some considerable extent. We're pretty sure that we know what the basic underlying theory is. The weak interactions have actually been described, at least the ones that are most relevant for low energy things like beta decay, were first formulated by Fermi in the 1930s. And he formulated a very successful but non-renormalizable field theory, which has been extended many, many times to include parity violation and quarks and so forth. But its modern form describes very well just about everything about low energy weak interactions and weak decays and so forth. But it's non-renormalizable. It's not a consistent theory at higher orders. And so this was the thing that motivated the standard electroweak theory. The so-called SU2 cross U1 theory. This is called the SU3 theory. And if you don't know what these symbols mean, you will by the end of this course. And these are called U1 theories. And this took all the good features of the Fermi theory and QED and put them together in a consistent, renormalizable package, made many new predictions for new phenomena, which have been observed and tested in exquisite precision. Some aspects, many aspects at the one part in 1,000, and some things even better. And so I'll talk about some of the tests, the properties of the so-called W and Z gauge bosons, which mediate, play the same role as the photon in QED. And the so-called neutral current, which was predicted. And the so-called Z pole, these are the experiments that produced directly these properties and studied their decays. And now I finally have to try to see what happens. Okay. So now if I can figure out how to get this down.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that will override all the automatic controls.
Oh, that's
suppose
good.
You want the, this one, right? The here one.
Yeah.
And the middle one.
Okay, that's the one I'll take down now. Thank you. Okay. So that all of this goes under the name of the precision tests. And much of the last, not the last, but for about 30 years, much of the field was dominated by these tests. And it passed just incredibly well. The final culmination of this was the Higgs boson, predicted in this standard model associated with the generation of mass for these particles as well as for electrons and so forth. And, or the Higgs mechanism, really, but the associated quantum of the field. The Higgs particle was discovered a year and a half ago. It's in Geneva, Switzerland. And I'll certainly describe that. The so-called CKM matrix. This is something having, this stands for Kabibo Kobayashi Maskawa, and it refers to the fact that one can, we have three families in nature, the electron and its, and up and down quarks, and then muon and strange particles and charm particles, and then a third family. And somehow there is some crosstalk between these families in weak interactions that is described by this matrix. And associated with this is subject of CP violation. To a very good extent, if you replace particles by antiparticles, the physics is the same. But the weak interactions don't really honor that. To a good extent, if you replace physics by its mirror image, replace left hand by right hand, the physics is the same. But the weak interactions don't really honor that. However, the product of those two operations is honored by the weak interactions to an excellent approximation. But in the 1960s, about a 10 to the minus 3 violation of this combined symmetry was found. And this is associated with this mixing between the families. It's especially relevant physically because it may, at least some form, this is actually probably more beyond the standard model, but some form of CP violation is needed if one's going to explain why there are more particles than antiparticles in the universe, which is a rather important fact. We wouldn't be here otherwise. That's called baryogenesis. Okay, neutrino physics. It was long thought that neutrinos, which only know about weak interactions and gravity, that it was long thought that they had no mass at all. But it was realized, hinted at, but really established definitively about 15 years ago, that they have tiny masses and that one can have so-called oscillations. That is, if you start out with a beam of one type of neutrino, say associated with the electron, it can oscillate into another type associated with muons. Very much the same way if you take two classical harmonic oscillators that are, to first approximation, independent, but then put a weak coupling between them. If you start one oscillating, eventually the other one will start oscillating, and back and forth. And so we'll discuss this. Finally, I want to talk about problems and outlook. So why we're never really satisfied, perhaps we should be, but there's still something to be done. There's still a lot to be done. There's still a lot for your generation to do, because there's clearly something else beyond the standard model, despite the fact that it's so incredibly successful. Okay, any questions so far? Okay. Supposing I want to describe a physical system. It might be elementary particles, or it might be some other physical system. It really takes three types of ingredients or things to understand a physical system. One of them is just the entities. That is, what are the objects in that system? What are the things you're playing with that you're talking about? Suppose you're talking about Newtonian gravity. What are the entities?
Massive objects.
What else do you need to know? What?
Interaction,
sure. How do they interact? What are the forces? And in this case, we know it's given by the inverse square law. What else do you need to know? Pardon me? That's true. I didn't really have that in mind, but you're correct. You really do need to know initial conditions. But I had something else in mind. Yes?
Symmetry?
No. No, you're making it too hard. Yes. Yeah, time evolution, or what I was going to just say is the response to the forces. What is the set of rules but you could call it time evolution just as well. And symmetries is actually valid point two here. In this case, it's F equals MA. Now, in particle physics, in atomic physics, one would have the same sort of thing. For the entities, one would have electrons and nuclei. For the interactions, you would have Coulomb's law. And for the response, you would have quantum mechanics, Schrodinger's equation. In particle physics, the entities are the elementary particles. I'll call them the fundamental particles. The interactions. And relativistic quantum field theory. Relativistic quantum field theory, which you already have studied, is the set of rules or the dynamics that determines everything. But you have to supplement it by knowing what the field theory is. You can write down an infinite number of field theories, but you have to know what the fields are and what the Lagrangian, the interactions are. And so here we're going to, and again, in this course, I'm going to use this as the framework, but talk about what the fundamental things are and the fundamental interactions. So the oh, I forgot, before I jump into that, let me do one other thing. Well, two other things. First, relativistic quantum field theory, I simply mean this is simply the union of special relativity and quantum mechanics. So it has relativistic kinematics, and it has the possibility to create particle antiparticle pairs out of energy and so forth. And at any given time, one's description, what is considered fundamental, et cetera, may be only an approximation, just as this was only an approximation to reality. And the standard model is undoubtedly just an approximation also. Let me, however, stop for a second and just introduce my notation. H bar and C are equal to 1. You can always restore any, so that means that there's basically everything has units of energy, or energy squared, or 1 over energy, or 1 over energy squared. And you can always restore the other types of units just by remembering that H bar in somebody else's units is 10 to the minus 22 million electron volts seconds. And H bar C is equal to 197 million electron volts times Fermi, and C is 3 times 10 to the 8 centimeters per second. Thank you. Remember, centimeters, seconds, even electron volts, all these units are just sort of human-based things and just having to do with how big we are and all that. And this is the real units of nature. Also, I will always use a metric g mu nu equals plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. Another problem, as you well know, is if you go to any two instructors or two books or something, they always have slightly different conventions and notations and so forth. Okay. Now, so what are the fundamental particles? Well, the fundamental our notion of what is fundamental changes with time. And so I'm going to first write down what we thought were, or what appeared to be, the fundamental particles in the mid-1960s, before the quark model, or early 1960s, I should say. And we now know that these are not truly fundamental, that there's another level beneath them, and there may be others as well. But at this time, we had the so-called strongly interacting particles, the ones that feel a strong force and which, for example, can bind to make a nucleus. And so these are called hadrons. And there were hundreds and hundreds of them, but the main ones were the proton and neutron, which had spin 1/2, and which make up in various combinations the ordinary nuclei. And then there were a bunch called the delta resonances, 4 of them. And these have spin 3/2. Then there were, for example, the pions, pi plus, pi minus, and pi 0, 3 of them, which have no spin. Another one called the eta, which also had spin 0. Some others called the rho plus or minus, and rho 0, which have spin 1. And then there are many, many more. And that particle data book, this is just a little tiny summary table of it. There's hundreds and hundreds of them listed. Now, most of these, other than the lightest, are what are called resonances. Which means they decay very rapidly into lighter particles via strong interactions. And so, for example, the delta plus decays into a proton and pi 0, or it could decay into a neutron and pi plus, etc. The mass of the proton and neutron, is about 938 million electron volts in energy units. The delta has a mass of about 1230 million electron volts. And the decay, so-called width, which is the inverse of its lifetime, is about 120 million electron volts, about 10% of its mass, which means that the lifetime is about 6.6 times 10 to the minus 22 MeV seconds over 120 MeV, so about 6.6 times 10 to the minus 22, 6 times 10 to the minus 24 seconds. So it only lives for 10 to the minus 23 seconds. This is called a resonance. And if you were to actually plot the cross-section, for example, for P pi 0 scattering as a function of the center of mass energy, you would find that it has a sharp peak at about the mass of this delta, and with a width that is given up to a factor of root 2 or something by the width, which is the inverse of the lifetime. It's just like any other resonance system in classical mechanics or atomic physics. So incredibly shortly lived. Similarly, the rhoes decay rapidly. Everything on this chart except the protons, neutrons, and pions, and the pions are about 135 million electron volts in mass. Everything else is a resonance. Yes?
So in this case, the resonances are not fundamental particles. But do they have to be composite particles? Could they be fundamental particles which are not stable?
Okay. I'm just trying to decide how to respond to that, because that could lead to about a 2-hour discussion. And The point is, yes, you could take the view and that the proton and neutron and pions were fundamental and that these resonances are merely short-lived bound states of them. That would be one point of view. However, at the time, most people, well, in the 1950s, people really tried very hard to take that point of view and wrote down field theories with protons, neutrons, and pions as fundamental and tried to treat it exactly that way. Those were never very successful. And by the 60s, people had realized that all these other things seemed to be almost identical, similar in properties, except the fact they, by the accident of being heavier, they could decay. So it wasn't really clear that you should think of this as a bound state of a proton in pi zero. It merely can decay into it because of the accident of kinematics. So people started thinking about them all as sort of equivalent, and there was a big movement in the 1960s called the bootstrap theory, which actually postulated that none of these things were truly fundamental, but they were all sort of the only self-consistent solutions to general ideas such as unitarity and other such things. And so bootstrap means sort of starting from nothing. That never panned out. And at any rate, we now understand that they're not, and that'll be another board, that these are in fact bound states of quarks. And so that's the clearly a much more accurate view. Okay, now a couple of comments about this. First of all, you notice that I put parentheses around some of those groups. That's because of isospin, or SU2 symmetry. All the ones that are put together like this actually have very similar masses. The mass difference here is a 4 or 5 million electron volts versus an average of about 930. And similarly, every other set are very close. And so, in fact, there seems to be no basic difference. They seem to be cousins or twins or quadruplets here. And they just come in these, some of them are all by themselves. We would call this a singlet. But they come into multiplets that are similar, just in the same way that in atomic physics you can have multiplets of states that just, for example, differ in the spin orientation of the electrons or in the 2L plus 1 orbital states. And they're nearly degenerate. These labels, these are electric charges here. This is negative charge, but if we're just talking about the strong interactions, that's really just a label. I mean, they are distinct particles, and electric charge is conserved in the decays, et cetera, but nevertheless, they seem to be just triplets or whatever. And it was thought that the strong interactions have a so-called symmetry, just as the 2L plus 1 states of a hydrogen atom in first approximation are degenerate with each other because of a rotational symmetry. These were thought to be degenerate, at least as far as the strong interactions, by a symmetry analogous to rotational symmetry called isospin. And actually, the mathematics of the isospin is identical to the mathematics of the rotation group. This was for the strong interactions only. Now, there is some difference in the masses, and it was for a long time thought that that was just due to the electromagnetism, which would be thought of as a perturbation. Actually, that works the wrong way. The neutron's actually heavier than the proton, and If it were just electromagnetism, you'd expect a proton to be heavier because of its self-energy. So we now actually understand that isospin is not quite an exact symmetry of the strong interactions, but it's to a good first approximation. The other comment here I'll make is that the meson exchange, such as a, for example, a proton emitting a pi zero absorbed by a neutron, for example, was thought to be a model, you know, responsible for the strong interaction, the strong nuclear force. And this is, of course, the Yukawa theory. From 1937, I think, in which he roughly predicted the mass of the pion from the observed range of the force. Okay, in addition to these hadrons, one had other particles. One had so-called leptons, which means light ones. It's a misnomer because now we have heavy leptons as well as light ones, but what are you going to do? And these are ones that do not field a strong force, would be a modern definition, not the mass, but so they're just completely blind to it. And the most famous would be the neutrino and the electron. And the electron feels electromagnetism, and the neutrino is almost ghostly. It doesn't feel either electric forces or strong forces. And these are spin 1/2. And the mass of the electron is about 500,000 electron volts, and the mass of the neutrino was long thought to be zero. We now know it's less than about 1 electron volt, but non-zero. Let me erase that for reasons that will become clear much later in the course. Okay, in addition to these, there were also photons, I'm calling them gamma, spin 1, massless, the force carrier, the quantum of the electromagnetic field that carries the electric force, and the gravitons, spin 2, massless, thought to, these purely hypothetical, there's this is never been observed, they would be too weakly interacting, but thought to be the analog of the photon associated with the quantization of the gravitational field. So let me put a little question mark here just to emphasize that that's purely theory. In addition, there were there were antiparticles, so antiprotons, antineutrons, positrons, antineutrinos. They, for some of them, one puts a bar, some of them changes the charge, some of them puts a superscript C for charge conjugate. Yeah?
We're discussing spin here.
Yeah.
Does he become relevant or important?
Well, helicity is not really a separate concept. Helicity is just a particular basis for the the projection of the spin. So helicity is P dot S. It's the projection of the spin on the direction of motion. So you use, instead of some fixed z-axis for the spin orientation, you simply say whatever its three momentum, this means the unit vector in the three, you project there. So a helicity plus a half electron means it's the spin is along its motion, and helicity minus a half, it's opposite. And that's, helicity is what is almost always used in particle physics. It's much more useful than any fixed z-axis. Okay, these antiparticles, some of them, the pions are actually, is its own antiparticle. Let me put a dagger, that is sometimes also used for antiparticle. So the pions are actually, don't have independent antiparticles. But antiparticles are not mysterious because they're required by, basically by special relativity plus quantum mechanics, as shown by Dirac, at least in the spin a half case. What was surprising is that there were strange particles. These were particles such as the, I'm not going to write down names or anything, but my names like kaons, hyperons. These were particles that were very similar to these hadrons here in their properties, except that they had exceptionally long lifetimes. They did not decay as rapidly as one might expect, at least some of them. Some of them did, depending on the masses, but some of them had long lifetimes. And that turns out to be because there's some approximately, there's some quantum number, new quantum number conserved by the strong interactions, but only violated by weak interactions. Then there was the discovery of the muon, and much later, its associated neutrino. At first, the muon was confused with the pion because it has a very similar mass of about 105 MeV. The pion's about 130. So it was confused for Yukawa's particle. And so it was, in old books, you see this referred to sometimes as the mu meson, but it's not a meson. Meson means spin zero. So these have spin a half. And this was the start of the point that there seems to be a second family. It turns out that the strange particles and the later discovered charm particles are just analogs of everything I wrote down before, except a heavier version, heavier carbon copy, except that they're heavier. And there's the famous quote by Robbie of, who ordered that? What good is it? Because we don't need these for ordinary matter. You're not made of muons. You're made out of electrons. You're not made out of strange particles. You're made out of protons and neutrons. So you're, why is this stuff there? Okay. Now, that was the old view. So this was the view in the 1960s. And so let me now fast forward to the current day. We now understand that these so-called fundamental particles are not really fundamental. At least the hadrons are not really fundamental. But now we understand that there are quarks. And these were actually first postulated in the 1960s, but it took a long time. The basic ones are the up and the down quark. And these have electric charge of plus 2/3 E and minus 1/3 E. E is greater than 0 is the electric charge of the positron. Benjamin Franklin made the big mistake of choosing the wrong sign convention. So E for me is always positive. And often if I write something like this, I'll forget to even write the E. And we now understand that the quarks are, that the proton is a bound state of two ups and a down. Neutron is a bound state of up and two downs. The pi plus is u d bar. Pi minus is u bar d. Pi zero is 1 over root 2 u bar minus d d bar. Those rho mesons are similar bound states, but with a spin 1, it's just a radial, it's just an orbital excitation or spin excitation. These are in the spin 0 state, and rho mesons have a spin 1. And all of the hadrons could be simplified in terms of these. The strange hadrons required additional quarks, the S quark and the charm, which are similar, well, charm and S. And then there's a third family, the top and bottom, that we now know. And we also know that there's the muon and its neutrino, and a still heavier one, the tau and its neutrino. The tau is much heavier, so it's not light one at all. And so now our understanding is that really these are the fundamental things. Maybe they're not even the most fundamental. Nobody's ever been able to, in any experiment, to find any evidence of substructure of the quarks or of the electron or the muon or the tau. And in fact, probably these are not composites in the usual sense. To some extent, the atom is a loosely bound state of electrons and nuclei. Nucleus is a fairly weakly bound state of nucleons. Proton is a relatively weakly bound state of quarks. And I'll have to quantify or justify that later. But we know that for example, experimentally, if the electron is a bound state of something else, the binding energy must be thousands of times stronger than the mass of the bound state. So if there is any compositeness in the usual sense, it's nothing like layers we've ever seen before. There may be some underlying superstring theory in which these are different vibrational modes of a string, but that's a different thing. Two more comments on quarks. Even though I said these are loosely bound states, in fact, nobody's ever been able to isolate a quark. They seem to be confined. And in some sense, that means when they're close together, they don't interact very strongly. They're weakly bound. But once you try to pull them far apart, the force becomes very strong, and you just can't pull them apart. It's a little bit like simple analog of that is you cannot break up a bar magnet into two magnetic monopoles, because if you tried to cut a bar magnet into two, you would simply get two bar magnets. Similarly, if you tried to pull a quark and an anti-quark apart, well, the strong force introduces some sort of flux between them. The farther you try to pull it, the more energy gets locked up in this flux tube, and eventually it just breaks and creates a U-bar U quark anti-quark pair. And so all you have is two quarks and two anti-quarks rather than isolated quarks. Anyway, that's an aside. For now, the more important thing is mention color. When Gell-Mann and Zweig postulated the quarks, they just had three of them, up, down, and strange. And that really simplified this whole hadronic spectrum, three particles instead of hundreds. Now we have six. That's still not so bad. But actually, they come in three varieties each, There's a red, green, and blue up quark. That is, they have another quantum number that wasn't known before. Red, green, and blue are not really optical colors, they're just labels. You could call them 1, 2, and 3, or X, Y, and Z, or whatever. And those labels, there's actually some symmetry between these that's described by a group called SU3. It's the basis of quantum chromodynamics. In addition to the quarks, we have three families of quarks. We have three families of leptons. We now have, for the force carriers, the gamma. We have gluons. These are eight analogs of the photon that are associated with the strong force and which mediate transitions. For example, U red can go into U blue, emitting a gluon, which you could say carries red and anti-blue colors. And it's the analog of the photon. There are also things called the W plus, the W minus, and the Z, which are associated with weak interactions. And all of these have spin one. These are massive. These are very heavy. These are massless. And it was the Higgs and Englert Nobel Prize for figuring out how to give these masses without messing up the mathematical consistency of the standard theory. In addition, we now have H, the Higgs boson, spin zero. This is the massive excitation of a new spin zero field that was introduced explicitly to give masses to these and also to these things. And then we still have the graviton. So this is the view in 2014 of what is fundamental. I think that this is likely to stay pretty much the same. There may be, for the foreseeable future, for reasons, as I was saying earlier with the electron and any compositeness, I would be very astonished if anybody found that this picture was basically wrong or incomplete anytime in the next 50 years, let's say. There may be new particles. I wouldn't be astonished if there were new supersymmetric partners or something like that, but I think that this structure will remain as sort of at least a subset of the fundamental particles. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, tomorrow I will give a little bit of an overview of the fundamental forces that act on these particles and their properties, and then plunge and some of their aspects and what their roles in nature are and so forth. And then I will start in talking about U1 gauge invariance and the Noether theorem and QED and its tests. Let me, on the website that I listed up there, I posted a little essay that I wrote for a full course on the standard model that I recommend that you read. It's not a repetition of this. It's a different aspect of discussion of the roles of the different interactions. And as I say, then I'll continue with this. And I will be around today. Please come in if you have questions. Feel free, and let me now give you a chance to ask any final questions for today. Okay, I'll see you.